My guest this week is Nick Anderson. Nick and I have known each other for what seems like an eternity because he was actually one of my flying instructors when I went through the Advanced Flying Training School at RAF Valley way back in the 1980s. He spent 19 years in the Air Force in a range of roles and then transferred into the civil sector in Virgin Atlantic, rising up to be a very senior captain on the Airbus A340 fleet. And as a result of all of that, he's got an incredible amount of leadership experience from both the military side and the civilian side, and that comes over very clearly in the podcast. These days, he's retired from flying aviation, but actually he's still very active as one of the hosts of the Airline Pilot Guy podcast, which is a very successful and amusing podcast that is very much focused around civil aviation. He also is a professional gun dog photographer, as in some of his pictures are, I have to say, amazing. And it was a great fun conversation, and I really think that there's lots in there that you can take away in terms of top tips around leadership and experience. And here we go. Hey, Nick. Fantastic to have you on the podcast. It's such a long time since we actually physically saw each other, but I'm really, really pleased to have you on, and I think it's going to be a really interesting conversation.
I'm looking forward to it, Bob. I seem to recall one of the last times we actually met in person was at your graduation dinner, where there were lots of cans of fake snow and lots of trousers coming down. I hope we get a chance to talk about those wonderful memories.
There may well have been in those days, yeah, because obviously having been one of my instructors at RAF Valley going through the Advanced Flying Training System, I did actually look this up just for amusement to see. And we first flew together on the 29th of September, 1982, would you believe? So that's quite some time ago. So it was definitely a different era in that time, for sure.
Well, at least it was on the Hawk, which is a relatively modern aircraft compared with most of the ones I flew.
Yeah, true. And some of those Hawks, of course, are still flying. I mean, the Red Arrows have still got some of the Hawks that I think will be in our logbooks, that's for sure. So,
brilliant.
Nick, you've had an amazing career journey. You obviously very successful RAF pilot, both in the operational roles and then also instructing. But then also an equally successful career with Virgin. And now you're doing stuff where you've got all sorts of different things going on, including a podcast that you participate in as well, and doing a whole load of professional photography. I'll be absolutely fascinated to get a bit of flesh on those bones not least for the listeners, just to get to know you a little bit more, if you can shed a bit of light on your career journey, as it were.
Well, yeah, what a damn journey, indeed. Now, I kicked off my flying life really at, you know, like a lot of us did, at a flying school, sweeping hangars and cleaning the toilets and taking bookings for the lucky students who had lots of money. I didn't. But I also was an air cadet like you. And I think we have many things in common with the start of our careers. I, too, got a flying scholarship. I had luckily been a staff cadet at a gliding school. So I had some gliding qualifications. So when it came time to get my PPL, I didn't need any extra hours. The flying scholarship covered that. I was the man. And off the bat of that, I joined the flying school as an odd, you know, just as a sort of general help around. But it was obviously a very hard way to gain hours. And I could see that it was no way to a career. So my father was an airline pilot, so he set me up to chat to the chief pilot of British United Airways, an airline that no longer exists. And he gave me a sage bit of advice, because he said, the market, young man, is flooded with qualified pilots, most of whom have type ratings, and you're trying to look for someone to sponsor you to learn to fly an airliner. So he said, best thing you could do, my lad, is join the Royal Air Force. So, I mean, I had been an air cadet. I had thoroughly enjoyed my life there. And it was the only way I was going to fulfill my dream of becoming a pilot. So in the mid-70s, I kicked off a career. And once I stepped into that amazing machine that is the RAF training system, or certainly was back then, I was absolutely hooked. They had the amazing ability to set you tasks that were just within your reach. And when you achieved that and you made your next goal, there ahead of you was another golden prize waiting for you. And it was just a revelation to me. I had no idea I was going to enjoy it so much. And it was going to be one of my life's, you know, most treasured memories of my times in the Air Force. Like yourself, I cracked through flying training pretty easily on the Jet Provost. But in those days, we still had Nats and Hunters to do our advanced training and weaponeering on. And off the back of those courses, I got posted to the Phantom. Did a tour on the Fighting Cox, number 43 Squadron up at RAF Lucas in Scotland, and spent a lot of my time doing fascinating flying, including policing the waters around northern Scotland and Iceland, intercepting Soviet aircraft, and escorted them in and out of our NATO area of interest up there. And then I got dragged kicking and screaming off to meet you, because we used to have to fill out a form. You know, every year it was an application to become a flying instructor. And the top was a box which said volunteer or non-volunteer. So I always ticked the non-volunteer, but my card had been marked by my boss, who probably thought that I needed a tour to steady down and learn a bit of responsibility. And he assumed that meeting you lot, only a few years younger and having fun in a hawk, was going to be the way to do that.
I was going to say, I'm not sure that worked that well then, did it?
No, it didn't. No, it didn't at all. But I spent 4 years in purgatory as a flying instructor, although it was to a certain extent the making of me. Came out of that and back to Phantoms, and then I managed to do what I really wanted to do, and that was to become a weapons instructor. So down at Coningsby for 6 months doing the Qualified Weapons Instructors course. And it was, having come top of the course there, my sort of prize for that was a posting on an exchange. Now, I know you've done an exchange, flying some tatty old F4 for the Luftwaffe, was it?
Or? That's the one.
Yeah, exactly right. How is your German nowadays?
Nicht schlecht.
Well, it's good to hear that. So, luckily mine was on a more exotic aircraft in a more exotic country. So F-18s in Australia for 3 years. And then out there, I got promoted and came back as a flight commander on the Tornado F-3, the air defense variant. And that's a story all on its own. 3 years on there, and I had decided that I needed to move on to another career. So,
were you there right at the beginning of the F-3? Because obviously the F-3 was fraught with challenges.
It was indeed. And even though we were getting the latest F-3s out of the factory in 1990, they were stage one. They were very nice, new stick tops, all the latest bells and whistles. It was still a bit of a dire aeroplane. Anyway, I had 3 years on that, and I realized my card had been marked and it was time to move on to another career. A year on the dole, and that was a hard year because, you know, no income is a bit of a problem when you've got a mortgage and a family and kids, etc. But eventually the floodgates opened and I had my choice of jobs, and the airline I picked was quite small, so Virgin only had 10 aeroplanes at the time, but they were buying a bunch of new Airbuses. And I came in on that wave of recruitment that they had there, which meant that I was very lucky when it came time for a command, because it only took me just over 3 years to get into the left-hand seat. And I stayed in there until I retired 25 years after joining. And there you go. That's it, into retirement, and that's what I've been doing ever since.
I cannot imagine a Virgin with only 10 airplanes. That's just extraordinary, isn't it? When you think of it now, though, it's a, you know, how they've grown. My goodness. That's a.
They have grown, but they've always appeared much bigger than they really are. They have about 45 jets and have had for a decade or more around that number, which is tiny. You compare it with Delta, or 800 airplanes, or might even be more than that. And United, the big American airlines, they are vast. Even British Airways is huge in comparison. But they hold a dear place, I think, in the heart of the traveling public. So they get more attention probably than they deserve.
Yeah, that's really. I didn't actually appreciate they were that small, to be honest. That is interesting because it's obviously not paying that much attention to it. I just kind of look at BA and Virgin in the UK as the two kind of big players. But you're right, that is pretty small.
Indeed, but they have cherry-picked some great destinations. So they're always there competing to go to some of the nicest places in the world.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I mean, it's a fascinating career. I'm amazed you fitted in the Nat, by the way. I mean, what did you sort of fold you in half and put you in there? Because you're not a tiny guy, and the Nat was a tiny aeroplane.
It was indeed. The doctor said, no, you can't. And I was desperate to fly it because, of course, the Red Arrows played around with the Nat. And I said, oh, sir, really, can I not? I don't really want to get all my training on the Hunter, which was the alternative. So they actually got me in all my kit and sat me in one, and the doc came in and he tried to squeeze two fingers between my shin and the instrument panel. And he said, oh, no, it's just not enough room, Anderson. And I said, oh, I'm sorry, sir, I didn't have the rudder pedals properly adjusted. And I reached down, did nothing, but I just pressed as hard as I could against the rudder pedals and forced my backside into the back of the seat and got just enough room for him to go, oh, okay, yeah, all right, then you'll do. And that was it. So I was pleased I never had to eject. I think I might have left some bits behind.
Yeah, that would have been painful, I suspect. That's for sure. No, I just missed a Hunter course at the Tech Weapons Unit. I would have been, I think it was two or three courses prior to me were the last Hunter course. So we were just out of that and into, obviously went hawk to hawk. So, but camouflaged hawks clearly instead of red and white hawks in the day. But as you say, flying training system, very different now. And you know, it is I think when I look at it now, I think how incredibly lucky we were in that kind of time frame to be going speedily through a system that was really well engineered and worked, as you say, flawlessly. And it was, I'm fascinated hearing you say about the building block thing. Because in fact, I was just talking about it in one of my recent podcasts. I remember first doing low level as a guy that then spent most of his career at low level, and doing that in a Jet Provost with an instructor sort of throwing it around down the North York Moors Railway. It was quite extraordinary. And I was going, how on earth am I ever going to do this? And yet only, relatively short period of time later, you're doing exactly that. And that step from the JP into the Hawk, where obviously it was a proper sports car and just was an amazingly different aeroplane to fly, was extraordinary.
Yeah, but a world-class trainer, both for the instructor and the student, because I think the Hawk was ideal for the time it came in with the Tornado coming in. The Nat suited a different generation when the pilots that trained on it were going to end up flying Lightnings and Phantoms, aircraft that had foibles and were trickier to fly than certainly the Tornado ever was. It was an absolute, it was an easy peasy lemon squeezy flying that thing. I think the Hawk was the perfect trainer for the time.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's interesting you say that because the Jaguar, of course, also had plenty of handling vices, and it was, you had to be quite careful coming off the Hawk onto the Jaguar because you just had to be much more circumspect about the way you threw the aeroplane around if you wanted to stay in it.
Oh yeah, I've got many good friends who flew it, and they used to describe, trying to stick into a small valley, how quickly the speed bled off when you started doing hard turns and how aware you had to be of your energy state.
Yeah, and things, bizarre things. I mean, if you rolled and pushed in the Jaguar, particularly with heavy centerline stores, if you had either weapons or a recce pod on the centerline, that was a sure way to throw the aeroplane into a departure. And at low level, you weren't recovering from that. So you had to be super, super careful about how you just how you literally move the stick around in the cockpit It became very instinctive over time, but it was definitely a challenging aeroplane to fly with a bunch of vices, especially given it was actually supposed to be a trainer when it was first conceived.
Exactly right. Yeah, I know. We lost a dear friend, Dave Plum, who went through training with us. He was doing exactly that kind of a maneuver out on red flag, and very sad to hear that his aircraft departed and he was too low to recover. Very sad.
Yeah, in fact, interestingly, I've got a little bronze statuette that I do believe was made of Dave Plum that a lot of us had at the time, which was a Jaguar pilot, and sadly, it was obviously it was his demise. Lots of people over time. I mean, in the early days of the airplane, I think it was desperately difficult. And as you say, thank goodness that's got better with more modern airplanes. And it's interesting as well how, as you say, Tornado F2 and then F3, really challenging when they came in. GR1 similar, actually. Jaguar similar, had massive capability enhancements over its lifetime. I mean, we have at least got better about that. And the Typhoon, when I was flying Typhoons as a brand new airplane, sure, it didn't have all the capability it has now, but it still had a lot of capability and a lot of performance. And the basic airframe was just amazing, which was a step change from where we'd been for a very long time in terms of capability. And clearly with JSF, it's as the newest boy on the block, as it were, it's another step up from that. So we're moving in the right kind of direction from an Air Force point of view, but not necessarily in all aspects. And flying training will be one of those where it takes forever to do it now.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I was 4.5 years from joining to becoming operational, and I thought that was a long time. But I was actually down at Valley last year on the base chatting to some of the students because one of my friends, dear friends, who crashed a Hawk was there. It was 40 years ago, and he wanted to go visit the crash site and just reminisce. So a few of us got together and went down with him, and we got an invitation to go to the mess and chat to the students. And it was a depressing time chatting to them and how slow they were getting through, how few they were, how dismal the mess was, nearly empty. I was just really worried actually about the state of the training system and what had occurred.
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, almost the last time when I left the Air Force 9 years ago, just coming up, and almost the last thing I did with a uniform on was present wings. That was at Linton, at what was a basic flying training school when I'd gone through it, but obviously was the then where they were doing basic fast jet training and awarding wings. So they still had to go through the whole of the Valley course and then obviously onto operational conversion units. The youngest person I presented wings to that day was 26. I was on the front line in Germany at 21.
Yeah.
And
big difference.
I mean, okay, they all go through university and a lot of them do a 4 year degree potentially. They'll have a year off between, et cetera, et cetera. So that drags the age out, but then the training system is absolutely not helping that. And it was interesting. I mean, when I did a podcast with Mandy Hickson, is one of the things that I picked up very clearly from her book as well, just how many holding postings she'd had as she'd gone through. Because, I mean, I had one, and the one I had was flying Hawks, between I was going, taking them from the maintenance unit at Abingdon back to Chivin at Broadie and Valley. So it's a completely different world, frankly. And I mean, I guess life's the way, you look through different spectacles if you're joining now, and you see different things and you have different expectations. But I mean, I certainly kind of look at it and think, wow, we were lucky. And not only we were lucky with that, but just the amount of flying we got as well. And you and I would have been in a similar boat with that, where we would have had a ton of flying hours per year doing some really exciting and interesting stuff, even if you were, tooling around in the upper atmosphere while I was, staying down in the weeds.
you wish.
So we sure had fun. That was great. I mean, you touched on sort of the early motivations. I mean, was it as simple as go join the Air Force because that's the best way to get a career? What was it that brought you into flying in the first place at all, from a young age?
Well, that's what got me into the Air Force, but certainly not my motivation. No, I grew up in a flying family, and I think it's often the way when you're introduced to a profession, and you see how much fun it is, and you know how it influences your family life. It is just brilliant. So my father was a wartime pilot like yours. He brought us up, you know, very well. We lived a comfortable life, as you can imagine. But I was the only one of his boys who had set his heart on becoming a pilot. And so I had my father to follow. I just hung on his every word as he came back from a trip and told me what had been going on, et cetera. Although his pet phrase was, oh, I just went there and back to see how far it was. But he was a marvelous example, a guy that made his way through civil airline flying from the DC-2, having flown the Sunderland in the war, commercially the DC-2, the Viking aircraft like that, Britannia, VC-10, 707, and he finished up on the 747. And I thought, wow, what a fabulous career. I mean, his life didn't end there. He ended up in Australia running a restaurant for many years as a restaurateur and then an avocado farmer. So, you know, wow, you never gonna stop working. But anyway, he got me into the air cadets, the air training corps. And I remember joining 6 months before I was supposed to, 12 and a half. But they said, oh, you can do your probation. You won't be a proper cadet until you get to 30. And on my 13th birthday, I got my sort of proper enrollment. And the air cadets became a huge part of my life. And I really fell into their way of looking after each other, of encouraging, working as a team. And slowly as your rank built, you ended up taking on more and more responsibility. I got onto a flight gliding course, and off the back of that, and a lovely friend who was a cameraman for CBS News, who was one of the civilian instructors, he encouraged me to apply to become a staff cadet at 623 Gliding School, which was at that old famous wartime base of Tangmere. And I had many a happy summer there, flying and manning the winches, driving, towing the aircraft up, recovering aircraft in, all that kind of stuff that your flying starts to seep into your blood, I think, when you're doing that. And I really wanted to be a civil airline pilot. But when I realized that there was no avenue for me, really, that's what got me in and motivated me to join the Air Force. And like you say, the Air Force have a way of sinking that hook in. You know, you might nibble at the bait, but then they give it a jerk, and you know, your next thing you know, you're off on the journey of a lifetime.
Yeah. I mean, I completely understand that. As you say, lots of stuff in common. I mean, I had the Air Cadets similarly. You know, I loved it at school. I was in the Scouts first and then joined the CCF, actually, at where I was at school. And I did everything.
Posh boy?
Yeah, exactly. That kind of doesn't show much often, does it? That was, you know, just fantastic. I mean, flying scholarship, gliding, international air cadet exchange I did as well, which was went to America.
Man.
Incredible. I mean, yeah. And just the opportunities it offered you. And I think just the kind of beginnings of that, into the independence, the discipline, all that sort of stuff that it brought in. I mean, it was just fabulous for me. And it just really, I found it very, very relatable. And because obviously my dad having died when I was very young, I think it just gave me a sort of purpose that perhaps I hadn't really had at that point. And I, a bit like you, actually, I was looking at Air Force or commercial. And for me, it was really easy because the commercial airlines just weren't recruiting anybody. So, you know, it was dead straightforward, go and join the Air Force. I mean, never for a second did I think that the next 34 years of my life would be in the Air Force, but that's the way it turned out to be. And it was and I don't regret a second of it. It was just absolutely amazing fun to do that. And, you know, what a world of opportunity it offered.
Yeah, it's still there, of course, the RAF cadets, but it's a bit like University Air Squadron. So they're a shadow of their former self, but I did instruct with them for quite a few years when I became a civil pilot because I had the time. So I gave back a little.
Yeah, it's like a part-time job being an airline pilot, isn't it? We'll come on to that probably.
It was indeed. I used to love it.
You're right. I think about the air cadets and the air squadrons. I mean, you know, as funding challenges is just part of that whole debate. And I mean, interestingly, the other thing I think's sad when we talk about the training system is, I mean, you may remember this, having flown with me a few times, that, I mean, I struggled desperately at Linton. I had a terrible time. I did just about every test there was at least twice. And I did think I did my basic handling test four times, which was pretty much unheard of. And I did two instrument ratings, two final nav tests, two final handling tests. And, you know, then I got to Valley and I won the bloody flying trophy. So I was a classic late developer.
Yeah, that was a mistake. I don't know how we managed to give you that.
Slipped through the net somewhere in there for sure. But the the sad thing is now, of course, that wouldn't happen because you get streamed to whether you're going fast jet, multi-engine or helicopters. That's going to happen at either at elementary flying training school or at university air squadron. So, you know, there is no such thing as a late developer now, really, because, you know, you're washed out of the system much earlier than that. If you're if they don't see you've got the potential very early on, then they just they don't take the risk, which I think is highly sad, really. But it is what it is.
Oh, it is. But hopefully they have the ability to see whether there is potential there. I would, you know, like to think that was the case. We went through a thing called the primary flying grading course. They were just looking to see if they could assess how well their students would do in the first 10 hours of flying. And then you went off to your flying training. And apparently their success rate at predicting who was going to get through and who wasn't was very accurate. But
I think that's true. I mean, if you look at chop rates of courses now, then they're negligible. So that would suggest you're right. I mean, you know, they're getting far more people with a greater success rate through, and there's obviously less seats as well. So, you know, that is also a bit of a factor, I guess, with all of it. Switching tack a bit though, Nick, I mean, so, and looking more at your airline side of life, I mean, this podcast, as you know, is all kind of leadership focused. I'm really interested in how you've changed and adapted your own personal leadership style really across your career. I mean, you've gone from Air Force, hair on fire, chewing razor blades type world into Virgin, where, as you said earlier, you know, you actually had remarkably fast success in terms of getting into the left-hand seat. And just how much difference there is really in the two things, and your perspectives on that would be really interesting, I think.
It is interesting because the Air Force, we all tend to think the same way. And I don't mean we're all like boxes, but we have a certain commonality in our approach to our world there. And it's accepted that your debriefs are going to be to the point of being blunt with whoever you're flying with. And you're really going to look to lead by example. And I think that is still true, but it's something that is inculcated in us as Air Force pilots that is not necessarily part of civil training. In fact, I don't think there's any true leadership training at all in the civil world. So when I moved across, I was used to being sharp. I was probably more abrasive than I needed to be. And I only had 3 years, just over 3 years, in the right-hand seat as a first officer. And so I was very good, of course, at taking orders, because we all are. So I was very pliant and courteous and, you know, happy to volunteer and do whatever SLJs, that silly little jobs that the captain had for us that day. But I did notice that there was often a very, very relaxed command style from some of the captains, which I actually enjoyed and is probably appropriate in a lot of cases. But when you need to put your foot down, then, you know, you do need to have that air of authority that comes with age and experience. And I certainly think that almost all the captains I worked with, because they were all very experienced, had that. But it wasn't necessarily something that was taught. It was something that they picked up over the years. So in the civil world, I had to learn to be softer in my approach to my colleagues. I had to be a listening man. I couldn't just blast in and give an opinion. I had to be able to converse also with everyone on the crew. And so, you know, we're only a two-man cockpit, so we often had relief pilots, so there could be three or four pilots on the aircraft, but there's another 15 or 16 cabin crew who come under your umbrella of responsibility, and learning to deal with their issues, not to tread on toes, because they always have a senior cabin crew who is also in that position of looking after them, but making sure that everyone understands who to come to if you know, push comes to shove, and making sure that you have got a receptive ear for absolutely anyone. CRM is a thing we bandy about, and it sort of is a coverall for being able or having the qualities you need to listen to people and acknowledge them, include them in the decision-making process, or certainly listen to their advice or their knowledge. Whether you decide to reject it or not afterwards is beside the point. We know of many accidents where had the captain had a word with someone down the back of the airplane, he might have a much better understanding of the situation he was in and might have saved a dreadful situation. So I think it's very important to be able to listen to everyone in your team. And of course, we had to embrace a just culture, which is not a problem, I think, for most Air Force people. We are very willing to admit our mistakes and put our hand on our heart and say, yeah, I that was dreadful. I completely messed up there. And, you know, I'm taking it on board, and I'll be doing my best to make sure that if that situation happens again, blah, blah. And it's very easy for us to put our hands up and admit a fault, which is really what just culture is all about. So long as your error is not egregious, everyone accepts it as being part of the learning process. And, you know, the culture in most airlines now is very good at accepting and forgiving. Additional training might be required if there's a lacking there. But generally speaking, it's, yep, okay, we've seen that. Let's move on now and do our best to cover the patch over and make sure that this problem doesn't happen again.
Yeah, I think it's a really interesting area, that whole the cultural piece, as you say. I think the aviation industry as a whole, military or civil, is a real exemplar for how that can be done well. In terms of the, you know, no blame culture by and large, and genuinely allowing a kind of open discussion, I mean, confidential reporting, those sorts of things that that we had in the Air Force, and the ability that you had to, you know, flag something, you know, regardless of who you were, and the fact that you wouldn't be blamed for it if it was a genuine mistake, and people would learn from it, you know, is a real plus. And I mean, it's interesting because obviously I do a lot of training work and corporate work these days, where, I mean, to be brutally honest, I think a lot of corporates could learn a lot from that, because I don't think the same culture exists very often. So it's certainly not a universal truth. There are some companies that are brilliant at this, but there are plenty that are not. And, you know, and I think that's a shame. And similarly, debriefing. I think one of the things, great strength of the military world was, you know, I said it to somebody the other day, you know, every single one of the 3,500 hours I flew, there was some form of debrief, even if it was just to myself. But more often than not, if it's a formation sortie, there's a formal debrief where you're going through the whole thing and picking the bones out of it. And I think that's something, again, having sat in the corporate world for a bit, that just doesn't happen often enough. You're as a result, often reinventing the wheel, doing things. You're not harnessing the positive things and making better use of those and reusing those. You're equally not learning the right lessons some of the time to move into the next thing. So you make the same mistakes. And it's, so, yeah, definitely there's some real challenges around that in terms of culture. How have you seen it over time? I mean, because I think one of the things, again, in leadership terms that I see quite a lot of is just a change in generations, which is generating quite a lot of challenges for even middle to senior managers in corporates nowadays. You know, are finding different expectations from youngsters. And this may be something that links into where you are on the podcast and so on that you do, looking more generally at the airline industry. Is that a challenge, or is it something that is just it doesn't really affect that sector.
No, I definitely think there is a challenge there. It's not so much generational now as it was generally perceived that the wartime pilots that moved into civil aviation were a very autocratic bunch. And if you hadn't been flying in the war, that you were tended to be looked down on. So the new generation of young civil pilots that have been trained at Hamble and places like that, I think they had a problem with the authoritarian attitudes of their commanders. And equally, their commanders often resented the relaxed, easygoing attitude of these young upstart pilots that they were having to work with. That, I think, is completely worked out of the system. I don't see any of that whatsoever. I do see a certain level of resentment about military pilots coming into the civil world. This preconception that they would be aggressive, they would be single-minded, they were single pilot, they didn't really think about anyone else. They're completely ignoring the fact that there's always a team to even get some poor old Jaguar pilot airborne. There's all sorts of people who have to be there, and he has to work as a team member with the other guys in his formation. So, there's always this strong element of teamwork and understanding of where the other people are and what they're doing. But that was not always appreciated by people who hadn't been through our world. They always assumed that we were going to be a bit arrogant, and that was a shame.
Yeah, I think I couldn't agree more with that. I think one of the most common myths I have to disabuse people of is that the military is authoritarian, and that's the only method that you use to lead people. You tell them what to do and they get on with it. And it couldn't be further from the truth. I mean, certainly in pretty much any of my Air Force leadership roles, if you'd get away with that if you really had to do it once or twice, because obviously there was a hierarchy and it was a military organization at the end of the day. But that wasn't the way you ever got people properly inspired and behind you as a leader. So it was a very common myth, I think, about military leadership in the round. And as you say, regardless of even if there's just one person in the final product, it is a very much a team effort. And everybody involved in the team is important to that, because without it, and it's not necessarily the ones that are directly spanner wielding on airplanes or air traffic controllers or everything else, it's the whole ecosystem that makes up the Air Force as is, or the Army or the Navy or whatever. And that's true just as much in any industry. I think it's the whole team endeavor, which is something I talk quite a lot about with companies I work with, actually, about how much they genuinely have a one team culture. I use the John F. Kennedy story quite a bit about his visit to NASA in the middle of the space race, when he went to what was then Cape Canaveral and was talking to the janitor on the hangar floor and saying, "What do you do?" And the chap looks at him and says, "Well, I'm here to help put a man on the moon, Mr. President." And that was the culture Brilliant. They had. Yeah, it's a great story. I mean, and I think the reality is, it's easy to be flippant about it and go, he was just taking the mickey, but he wasn't at all. I mean, in reality, that was the culture they had created. And precious few companies do that. I think they'll have a kind of hierarchical structure in terms of the client facing part of the company versus all the support back office services and so on, who all too often are rather the poor relations in the organization and don't necessarily get the same treatment in any way, shape or form. And leadership for me is all about bringing that whole team together. And particularly if you're at the top of the organization or close to it, that's a really important facet.
Absolutely.
Going back in, a little bit in terms of looking back across your career, role models, who kind of really impressed you and why?
Interesting. I think probably my first flight commander had a very strong influence on how I was going to conduct myself for the rest of my career. He, big guy, big, tall, elegant guy with a lovely moustache. Andy McHugh, he dwarfed me, and he was a navigator, and he was a very well-spoken and gentleman despite his size. But he provided the biggest umbrella over his junior pilots and navigators than you could possibly imagine. And I, as soon as I realized that if I came to him with a problem, he would fix it and he would protect me from a lot of the repercussions that would occur if I allowed the problem to be discovered. So if ever we did anything wrong, you know, a few hijinks in the mess, burnt another piano or whatever we did, we always made sure that we let Andy know and that we fronted up with whatever was needed to fix whatever we'd broken. And he then endeavored to shield us from the fury that came down from the president of the mess committee or the station commander or whoever. And sometimes he would hand out arbitrary punishments, which were never terrible, but he would always say, well, I'm sorry, sir, I've already dealt with this. You know, I've already handed this man a punishment. We can't punish him twice for the same issue. Andy, and he had a fatherly attitude towards the youngsters. And unlike yourself, I was pretty young. I was only 21 when I was on 43 Squadron. So, you know, that I thought was fantastic. You get him over a few beers. He had been a navigator on Vulcans. And it was his job as one of the junior navigators, if ever they were given a nuclear scramble, to run out to the huge blue steel missile that hung underneath this Vulcan. And with this big lead-lined bucket, he had to go under the missile and empty the ball bearings that had sat inside the hollow nuclear ball, the core, so that when the weapon went off and all the explosives forced this nuclear core into one mass and fission began, it could do so. But because it was a fairly fragile piece of kit, whilst they were just flying around, they had it stuffed full of ball bearings so that it accidentally start coming apart. And he's telling us stories like this. And I said, well, what about the radiation? And he said, yeah, we didn't really worry about that.
I was just thinking, having started out as in the nuclear role at Bruggen, with I think we'd got slightly more sophisticated weapons by then, thank goodness, because there was no ball bearing emptying involved. But oh my goodness, yeah, the health and safety would have fun with that today, wouldn't they? Dear, can you imagine?
They would indeed. He's sadly not with us. I can't remember what he passed away with. I hope it wasn't cancer. But yeah, that was an interesting job for you out there, wasn't it, holding nuclear cues?
Oh yeah, I mean, you know, and talk about, wow, you know, baptism of fire, literally, you know, as a youngster, you know, you walk into the hardened aircraft shelter and there's a jet with an atom bomb on the bottom of it and it's yours and you've signed for it. And I think the amazing thing with that, when you look back on it now, is how well kept some of the secrecy was around that. I mean, you know, clearly it's well known that we did the role, but even at Bruggen, where obviously we had, you know, aircraft on quick reaction alert the entire time, you know, loaded and ready to go, there were a lot of people who really didn't know what went on. I mean, it was obviously massively highly classified in its day. And I can still remember when we were changing over to the Tornado, we actually had a gradual degradation in the number of aircraft we had on state. And we ended up down with one, where we had one Jaguar pending the first Tornado taking over and we're moving back up. And we had things like, we had that a bit like you'll have had this on Air Defence QRA. You had all your kit ready to be able to throw on the life jacket and all that sort of thing. So that was in with the aircraft and it had to be changed, you know, routinely for its servicing. And for whatever reason, they came across from safety equipment to do this. And there was none of my ground crew were busy doing something else. And so I said, well, just come with me and we'll go and do it. And we walked down to the shelter and unlocked the door. We had this wacky system because obviously in most nuclear stuff was a two-man principle. So the policeman had one key to one padlock on the shelter door, and I had the other key, and so we both had to unlock our doors and then unlock our locks, and then you could open the door. And I walked in, and he had to come in with me because obviously it was a no loan zone as it was called in there, and I had to have two people in the shelter. And so he literally stepped over the threshold of the little wicket door into the shelter. Just behind me, and I just strolled up to the front to the airplane, picked up the life jacket, and looked around, and he was still in the doorway, and if his mouth could have got to the floor, it would have been on the floor. Because he clearly, up to that point, he just had no, you know, he clearly heard the rumors and knew a bit about it, but he clearly never seen an atomic bomb, you know, had no clue that, you know, this was really there. And it was just, I know it was a fascinating moment for me. I've never forgotten it, because you think, wow, you know, we were just taking this for granted that this is what we did, and, you know, and just got on with it. But yeah, but it was, as you say, it was a pretty chunky, responsible job at the time. I'm fascinated by your story about your flight commander putting the umbrella up, though. I use exactly that example all the time when I talk about leading teams, and the way you should actually do it is you should be putting an umbrella up and protecting your people, as long as they are coming to you with, you know, when they've made mistakes and they're owning up to it first, and you're not having to find out from somebody else. I mean, I can imagine in your case, that was a pretty regular occurrence. You were walking into his office to tell him about things, but
yeah, it was indeed.
Yeah, well, those were the days, that's for sure. Looking right back in time then, Nick, I mean, with all that, we'll, you know, before we move on to something else, just, you know, if you were talking to school age Nick with everything you now know and all the rest of it, what advice would you be offering on all things about leadership and, you know, careers and so on and so forth?
That's a very interesting question, actually. What would schoolboy Nick need to know to have a fabulous and rewarding flying career? Well, very interestingly, I don't think he would need to know anything. So I would tell him, just carry on, Nick, and enjoy the ride. I would caution myself not to take life quite as seriously as I did. I have a feeling that I always felt honored to be where I was, and a little bit bemused that I had achieved what so many other people that had started the journey with me had failed to. And I often thought, well, I wonder if they just got the name wrong, or that my letter that was dismissing me from the service had just got lost in the post. So I was a little bit bemused by the whole success of my career. But whilst I was riding the wave, I just let it carry me forward. And funny enough, even though I've sort of stumbled through life, making decisions almost at random and or letting life make decisions for me, the way it's turned out has been just about damn perfect. There are very few things I would not wanted to have done, except perhaps my last tour in the RAF, which was far from perfect. But other than that, that was the only blip, and a great fun and highly enjoyable career.
Yeah, it's great when you can be in that position, isn't it? I'm exactly the same. I, you know, when I left after 34 and a half years out of the Air Force, you know, I can literally hand on heart say I didn't have a single job that I didn't enjoy. There were obviously highs and lows. Some of those were bigger highs and bigger lows, but but overall, every single tour I had, you know, I came away from it thinking that was really satisfying and enjoyable, with different challenges along the way, obviously. But I mean, it's lovely to be in that position. That's for sure. Just again, just on traits, because and things you've picked up along the way here as well. What are the leadership traits that you value the most, and not only for yourself, but I mean, that you look for in others? And again, I'm particularly interested in linking to the airline side of life here, in terms of what you're looking for from the people that worked around you and your fellow flight deck and in cabin crew, in terms of the important leadership traits that they had or indeed didn't have.
I think everyone respects someone who is professional and knows their job. So I think the first thing you've got to do is look to yourself and be the best person you can in whatever role you are. I always admired the senior cabin crew, girls or gents, whoever they were, if they had a real grasp on what was going on. They knew their people well. They could remember all their names. They knew a little bit about them. They conducted their briefings in a very professional manner, but also in a relaxed manner that encouraged bonding between themselves. They didn't set themselves apart. So those kind of people were always a delight to have on board, because you knew that the important part of the aircraft, the bit behind the flight deck, where the 350 people who paid your wages were sitting being looked after, that was all going to go smoothly. The opposite side of the coin was, of course, the odd one where you realize that every little problem that occurred in the back of the aircraft was going to come up to the captain because they just didn't want to shoulder any responsibility whatsoever. They felt that if they brought every issue to the captain and you made a decision on it, then they were covered. And that kind of thing is really hard work to deal with because we've got our own job up the front there. I've already explained, and I always made sure I met all the senior people on my crew. In fact, I always introduced myself to the whole crew. And if I hadn't got to their briefing because I was really busy before departure, I was going to walk up and down the airplane as soon as I could and just make sure everyone saw my face and saw me have a grin and promised to buy them a beer when we landed, etc., so that they felt that I was approachable. And I always felt as a captain that was absolutely essential. You never set yourself apart from the crew. You know, you're always there to help them and go a bit beyond if necessary. I mean, we had some really difficult occasions with the crew. If I could just tell one anecdote, perhaps.
Oh, yeah, please.
Flying out of Heathrow to Boston, we got a bomb warning on the aircraft. So somebody on the aircraft had written a warning on a napkin and hidden it in the toilet. And when it was discovered, brought to the flight deck, and there was this piece of hand towel with a warning suggesting there was a bomb on this airplane that was going to blow up. So, of course, we have a procedure to go through to get the airline security people onto it to assess the quality of the threat. And we started this process. It was a bit of a nightmare. We started this process on the radio, but very soon we ran out of radio range. So we had to switch to the ACARS, which is the sort of tele printer style of communication, which we did. And we were meanwhile starting our transatlantic crossing. And as we fell out of range of that, the satellite or HF system that's supposed to take over failed. So we just lost all ACARS. We'd had a preliminary assessment of green. So that's what I went with. And we carried on our flight. Now, this was all fine until we landed at Boston. And there, the local FBI and TSA agents met us. And I remember taxiing in. And I'm looking to my left because that's where the entrance to the jetway is that they're going to maneuver onto the door once we're parked up. And all I could see in this open part of the jetway was a crowd of guys in black uniform with flak jackets and artillery pieces, sidearms, you know, old helmets. It was just terrifying.
I can only imagine.
Oh, my Lord. Exactly. Here we go. Anyway, they came on. They impounded the aircraft. They took away all the passengers and put them in a separate, because normally we go through the same area in the airport. They took all the crew separately. We went through immigration and then we were locked in a room. And then they took us out one by one to be interviewed. And with regards being a captain in that situation, I was trying to work out what was going on whilst not being informed because, of course, they weren't going to tell me anything and if they could possibly avoid it. I got through, but quite quickly I discovered that one of the cabin crew had, for whatever reason, fallen under suspicion. And they were taken away and given an additional chat. And eventually I managed to get all the crew, it was several hours after landing, together on the bus, had a long chat on the way to the hotel, got a few drinks organized and continued in the hotel. And meanwhile, I managed to get the story from this one cabin crew member that had been dragged away. And turned out that they were very interested in this particular individual. Now, they said that they wanted to do another interview. So I said, well, look, whatever happens, if you're taken away for an interview, first thing you do is call me. And I will come and accompany you in any further interviews that you're there, particularly if it's a voluntary one and I'm not physically excluded, which it was going to be. And then, of course, the phone call started with myself and the company and our legal branch, et cetera, to try and work out what facilities we had and how we could generate some legal advice. I was woken only a few hours later by this cabin crew member who said, oh, they want me to meet them in such and such a room for an interview. And so I was straight down there, unshaven, smelly, and walked in, and there were about nine of these guys there, you know, and they said, oh, yeah, thanks very much, purely voluntary. I sat down beside the person, and off they went. And it was started off as a very comfortable chat about, you know, life in the Virgin and, you know, what they did and how they did it, how they got promoted, what occurrences that they had of any interest in their lives, all this kind of stuff. And it ended up with them absolutely pointing the finger, saying, you know, we've had people doing forensic tests. We know it was you. Come on, tell us, now's the time. It'll go a lot easier on you. And I had to put my hand on this, on the shoulder of this person and say, you're here voluntarily. You don't need to answer any more questions. My advice to you now is that we stop this interview and we go and regroup. And you need to start speaking to some experts that I will arrange for you. And they were very reluctant to let us go. But
not so voluntary then.
Yeah, exactly. But they said, oh, we need to hear that from you. And so he repeated word for word what I'd said. And I got him out of the room. And as I was leaving, one of these great big guys standing right in front of me, and invading my personal space, looking down on me, and I'm a big bloke, saying, whose side are you on? Except it wasn't quite that nice. And that entire day then, before our flight home in the evening, was organizing what we were going to do, whatever. And what we got the crew involved, got volunteers who were going to stay in Boston if this person was arrested so that they could keep an eye on. Basically, we had 24 hours of absolute nightmare, well, on very little sleep. Well, when we got to the airport, we were fully expecting to have the person arrested, but nothing happened. And we departed and flew back and, again, had another long chat with the station managers once we got back to Heathrow. But it was a perfect example of how you need to think about more than just having your rest and getting back in the airplane because that's my job and flying home. You're there as a representative for your company, but more importantly, you're the boss of the crew. And you need to be able to take responsibility for what happens and nurture and look after them so that they can get through whatever situation they've got themselves in without any hassle.
Yeah, no, it's great. That's a terrific example. I mean, I have to say I've always thought on, particularly for the cabin crew, perhaps less so the flight deck crew, some of the challenges in the leadership space are around dealing with some of the passengers. And they must have to have, you know, in some instances, the patience of saints to deal with some people. When I've sat on plenty of airplanes in various seats in the in various different compartments of the airplane, and I do, I cringe some of the time at, I mean, things like safety briefs always drives me nuts. You sit there with people in exit rows who don't pay any attention whatsoever to the safety brief and things. And you think, I would struggle with that if I was cabin crew and just being, you know, playing appropriately nice, but at the same time having to be really clear and firm. It was interesting, actually. I was talking to another very good friend of mine who was, we were on Jaguar Squadron at the beginning of my fast jet career together, who's a he's a BA, very senior BA 777 captain, and we were talking about the recent Japanese evacuation where they had the fire on landing after obviously that very sad impact with the Coast Guard airplane, and yeah, they got everyone off, and I think the discipline involved, and I'm sure you've talked about this on your APG podcast, because the discipline to get everybody off in those kind of circumstances with zero preparation time, I mean, literally none, and there was no sense there was any kind of emergency, and then suddenly there was a massive emergency. I think it speaks volumes, but actually for the passengers as well as the crew, but also for the, for the cabin crew to actually be able to get everybody off in that sort of scenario. And I mean, certainly when I was chatting, we were musing that would it have been the same if it was over here? And I think it probably wouldn't because of passenger discipline as much as anything else. But I don't know what you think.
No, exactly right. I mean, not from all the videos I see, not one piece of hand luggage was picked up by the passengers. And that's such a common problem during emergency evacuations. We know that just one piece of hand luggage can block an aisle and make it nearly impossible for people to get past. It can damage a slide and ruin one of your escape avenues. And all the questions, why do I need to do this? Why? What's going on? Tell me, when the cabin crew themselves in that situation wouldn't have had much of a clue of what the hell was going on. They just knew they had to get everybody off. And I despair sometimes at commentators, because we had an evacuation in our company on the runway at Gatwick once, and the commentator was haranguing one of our representatives saying, why were the cabin crew, they lost control, they were screaming. Well, they were, they're taught to use a very loud voice to demand that the passengers do what they say and get off the airplane in the correct manner. They're not losing control and screaming. They're actually trying to keep the attention of everyone on board. And if you ever go to one of their training scenarios when they're in the training rig and they're conducting an emergency evacuation, that's exactly what they do. They stand up and they shout very loudly at everybody. Now, some young girls, they high-pitched voices, it might sound a little like screaming, I guess, but no, they're just trying to get your attention and get you to move off the aircraft. So it really frustrated me, the level of ignorance there is even under so-called experts.
Yeah, I totally can get that. I mean, there's the one thing you want at that point is compliance. This is not the time for discussion. This is a time for obedience. You know, I require you to do this and I do it now.
Exactly, right.
For sure. Yeah. We could talk for hours on this stuff. So I mean, and maybe some other time we will do that. But I always look at highs and lows on these podcasts for individuals, and kind of every, as we talked about, you know, no matter how enjoyable and successful your time is, inevitably you'll have had some of those. What do you wish you'd done differently when you look back across your career now, and why?
There's one tour that was a real downer for me, and sadly, of course, it was the last tour I had when I was in the Air Force, and it kind of helped me make up my mind as to what I was going to do. So it was my only tour as a full tour as a senior officer. I'd just come back from Australia, where I held down some jobs as a squadron leader. I'd been partly their fighter combat instructor, because those guys were leaving their squadrons as fast as they could to get into Qantas, because there were some really good jobs going. And they could do so at very short notice in the Australian Air Force. So a lot of it was just stopgap filling, and I was a flight commander when I left. But this was going to be my RAF, proper RAF command tour as a flight commander. Sadly, I had a personality issue between myself and my boss. And the biggest regret I have is that I didn't find a way around this, that I couldn't get over the difficulties that we were having, communication difficulties, resentment, and all, a deliberate switching off of information to me. I was always the one left behind to look after the remnants of a squadron on a major detachment, this sort of thing. And I felt I was almost being punished. My annual reviews that had been sparkling suddenly deteriorated very rapidly. And I felt completely demoralized. And I felt if I found a way to get over that hump and communicate exactly how I felt and why I was so dispirited, I thought I could have still turned that around and made that tour a success. As it was, about halfway through, I could feel the way life was going and had my tea leaves read by, where were the lords and masters who posted us
there? Innsworth, probably in those days.
Yeah, it was, I think. And they said, well, you've got to do ground tours anyway because, you know, you've never done a ground tour and you need to do at least one before you even think about staff college and you're well out of the age bracket now, etc. So, I could see the writing was on the wall. Funnily enough, having made my decision and put in my papers to retire after it would have been 19 years, after a couple of years, of course, that particular boss moved on. And along came Wee Stevie, who was an absolute breath of fresh air. And I suddenly realized that if the situation had been different and Wee Stevie had been running the outfit from the word go, my life would have been very different. And I might well have had a completely different end to my career. As it turned out, it was an avenue into a different role. That's all different. Career path, that's all.
Yeah, every fork in the road offers different opportunities, that's for sure. But it is sad, isn't it, how, and I think that's true in a lot of walks of life, how one individual can often be make such a massive difference to your personal progression and satisfaction and enjoyment of something. And also how lonely sometimes these positions are, because it's quite difficult to then turn around and find a way through that. And who else are you going to talk to? How are you going to get advice in terms of navigating that? So yeah, I really feel for you. That's a nasty situation. I mean, we've all seen many of those, I think, sadly over the years, but it's tough to get caught in one. I mean, I'm guessing that's probably also your career low point, but from what you've just described, but
pretty much.
I mean, what's the high point though? There must be there was the thing that is your most important, you know, achievement and the kind of thing that you look at most fondly.
The high point was probably my tour in Australia. I think we all enjoy an exchange tour. We would love to. But I think the most memorable event, if we can center it under that, well, it could be blundering through a place called Pine Gap in Australia, which was the one and only permanent avoidance zone in the entire Australian continent. And it was only about 5 miles across. So one red circle that was never changed, and it was over this place. And I had no idea it existed. And I must have been the only person in Australia who didn't realize what it was that I was about to fly over. So I had a little bit of inertial navigation drift, thanks to the Schuler Loop, which I'm sure you know lots about, having spent years with an inertial navigation system.
A little bit.
Anyway, I was aiming to avoid it on my moving map as I approached Alice Springs in a Hornet. And I dropped my wing to see what it was, and I wasn't avoiding it at all. I was smack over the top of a whole bunch of big white golf balls, you know, those covers they put over very large satellite dishes. And it turns out the Pine Gap was a combined US-Australian secret base run by the CIA, and you weren't allowed to fly over it by ever. Anyway, I managed to do that. So anyway, blundering through Pine Gap was an interesting thing. I think I was very lucky. My last tour, I managed to win the Strike Command Spitfire Trophy for operational shooting in air-to-air gunnery. I was very proud of that, but I was never awarded the trophy because I was leaving the Air Force and they couldn't be bothered to give it to me. So that doesn't win. The thing that wins in my career really was my first Soviet intercept. bearing in mind we're in the middle of the Cold War, and it is the one thing that has concentrated our minds for decades now. And I was only a few days after my 21st birthday. I wasn't even operational. We'd been out on a big naval exercise, helping to defend this combined NATO fleet. Our controller was sitting on Forrestal, USS Forrestal, and we were going around the cap on the outskirts of the fleet when he said that there were some visitors from the east coming. And Tony bound my backseater knew exactly what that meant. I hadn't a clue. And off we tootled to go and chase down these contacts. And there were a pair of bears coming through the fleet. So I was going, oh, my God, this is it. This is, these boys are the enemy. And there we were. There, one of them was, I think, a Bear Bravo with a Crown Drum radar that normally carried a big kangaroo air to surface missile. And the other was a modified Alpha, which was a fairly recce thing. And we weren't allowed to fly over the fleet because they usually had air operations from the two carriers, I think, that were in this fleet. But, of course, escorting these bears, the bears weren't going to not fly over the fleet. They went through the whole fleet at about 2,000 feet. And we were luckily one of the few fighters airborne because the sea state was too bad for the Americans to launch at the time. And it was just so exciting. It was just unbelievably exciting. I was, you know, sitting beside this huge Russian bomber, all gleaming aluminium and a strange combination of pretty and ugly rivets and pot marks and scratches and holes. And the only bit of paint was the vast red star that was on the tail. And waving at the Russian crews who were all sitting around in various blisters and portholes waving back. It was really something I will never, ever forget. And also managing to do my first seven-hour mission without resorting to the piddle pack.
Oh, yeah, well, that's pretty impressive in itself. Now, I can imagine the bear thing. I mean, any of those sorts of missions, I think, are, you know, that's definitely defining, isn't it, when you do that sort of thing? And because it was a really real game. I mean, that was the thing that I think was very apparent. I did my own kind of near equivalent to that was going when I arrived in Germany on my first tour and fairly early went to go and visit the inner German border. And as much as anything, it was about showing us that, you know, what this was all about and that this was, you know, there was a real kind of thing we were here for. And we had a whole set of briefings and then we got airborne in a Puma and we were flying up the, literally right up the border, looking at the fence. I mean, you could obviously couldn't do that in a fast jet. You weren't allowed that close. But within literally a couple of minutes of us getting airborne, we were joined by a Hind helicopter from the other side that was then shattered us going all the way up. And he was 100 yards the other side of the fence. So, and that was, again, you know, you're sort of whites of the eyes stuff. You know, you're looking at at the bad guys. It was absolutely fascinating to do that. That's for sure.
And it was a different time.
Work-life balance, Nick. You know, you've moved through two careers into retirement, and you've obviously seen an awful lot of different stuff here, and two very different lives in terms of an Air Force one and then an airline one. I mean, what do you think now, and what do you do now to kind of manage your work life balance and keep yourself on the right side of that?
Well, very luckily, I don't have much in the way of work, but I think one of the things looking back on my career now, I was not good at was that managing the amount I gave myself to do. So I think the advice I would offer anybody is not to overburden yourself such that you start stressing over the tasks you haven't yet completed. And in that comes the ability to pass work on to others around you who could equally do it. That delegation, it is vital. And the way you do it is also very important. So it doesn't feel like you're shirking, but it makes the person you're giving a job to feel like this is something that they can do to both assist and improve their own ability as well. But I let it get so serious at one point that I started to end up in a stress spiral that grew and grew and grew. And I didn't really know what was happening to me. It was partly what was happening at home. Nothing particularly difficult. It's amazing how sometimes even the smallest job becomes overwhelming when you have got so much on your plate that you feel, and you've so much left undone, you still got to do, and you worry about it. Your sleep starts to suffer, and that itself leads to an amplification of the spiraling stress situation. It got to the point where I went up to my manager at the airport, J.J. Burrows, a lovely man who had also been a student of mine at Valley.
I was going to say, I know him.
And, I thought you might. And sat down and burst into tears because I just reached a point in my life where I just couldn't manage anymore. And, for me, that was devastating. Just that loss of control was something I thought I would never recover from. And JJ was incredibly professional and helped me a great deal, but more importantly, put me straight in to see our company doctor, who's a lovely Irishman. And we sat down and started talking, and I very soon realized when he explained to me that I was far from the first pilot he'd seen that had been through this sort of situation. And it gets to the point where your fight and flight system is continually being recharged. Your body is full of adrenaline all the time because you haven't found any release from it at all. Company were brilliant. They put me on medical leave. I myself sought out a therapist. I tried various things. I didn't like antidepressant drugs. They made you feel completely disassociated, and that wasn't a feeling I was prepared to cope with. So what got me out of this was seeing a therapist, cognitive behavioral therapist, CBT, just the opposite of the person you'd expect me perhaps to get on with, a bit of a sackcloth and ashes lady, but she understood what the problem was. She very quickly understood me, and she started writing me checklists of things to do. It took me 6 months to get over this issue. The company were brilliant. They looked after me, and they said the job's waiting for you as soon as you're declared fit. I had to go and see trick cyclists and of various seniority until eventually I was declared fit, got my medical back, and went back to work. And ever since then, I have had this in the back of my mind that it doesn't matter how solid you seem to the rest of the world, inside all of us, there's the potential to suffer from a mental health issue. And the reason I mention it is that I'm not embarrassed about it. I understand what happened to me. It is an illness. It's not something that people make up. It's not something that you can shake yourself out of. You have got to rebalance the chemicals that are cursing around through your body such that everything gets onto an even keel again. And then from that situation, everything starts to come back into perspective, and you can see a path through. And I just welcome anyone who has, particularly if you're in the sort of job where it is often considered a real problem to your career, and that might include the military, that might include aviation, the medical profession, anyone in a high-stress job, to be open about it as much as possible, because the more we talk about it, the more likely we are to understand it and recognize what's happening to you before it gets to the state where you have a real wall to climb and you can just fix it or get it fixed, get some help early on.
Thanks for that. It's such a powerful point, and thanks for sharing. I mean, it's a, I think it is an area, isn't it, where we've got much better societally at acknowledging, recognizing, and dealing with all things kind of in the mental health space. But I totally agree with you. I think that if I look back on, you know, a couple of times, I've not got to quite to the point you did, but I could see it could go there. And the and absolutely finding ways to either have people who are going to advise you, you know, and be you know, you're comfortable enough with the relationship that they can help you at the right points to turn around and stop you before you get to the cliff edge, or actually knowing it in yourself as well is such an important thing too. No, it's really, that's really powerful. Thank you, and that's terrific.
No, self-help is the way to go. If you can recognize it and start a regime to ease your problems and tackle it early, it's so much simpler. If you let it do like I did and try and ignore it and pretend it's not there, eventually it will come up and bite your backside.
Yeah, it's going to catch you out for sure. No, that's, yep, that's terrific. I always like to try and explore the professional world of all the guests I have on, Nick. And I'm very conscious that you, a part of the Airline Pilot Guy podcast, and perhaps talking about that and linking to where I'm going to go with this, we'll be linking a number of themes together. But just looking at civil aviation in general, I mean, there's so much pressure on it at the moment in terms of environmental challenges, and people turn around and go, you mustn't fly because it's really bad, and therefore, you know, do other things. And the and finding a way through that is obviously going to be challenging for the industry, because clearly it's got a massive place in terms of the transport infrastructure and everything else. I'm just interested in how you see that, and potentially you've seen that in terms of some of the discussions you've had on your own podcast, and also just about challenges and opportunities for the aviation sector as well. Where does that go in terms of what you're seeing?
Civil aviation is driven by greed, and there's a demand to go as cheaply as you can around the world. And all the time that someone wants to go on holiday and they don't want to spend more than 50 quid to get there, there is going to be this huge demand for cheap air travel. And the industry is only going to grow as the population grows. So I don't see a way that anything will change unless we start running out of resources. I don't see a technological system that is even in its early stages that has the likelihood of replacing what we have in our current powering of aircraft, you know, jet fuel that we've sucked out of the ground and partly refined, bearing in mind that, you know, you can run jet engines on almost anything. But the more we demand incredibly fuel-efficient jet engines, the tighter the parameters are. My brother was an aircraft engineer, and he said, you can run a jet engine on coal dust, but you can't run one of the modern jet engines on coal dust for sure, because they are very highly tuned and efficient pieces of kit. But in order to find a jet engine that'll take, hydrogen fuel or something equivalent, very hard. Are we going to have electric-powered ducted engines? If so, how the devil are we going to store sufficient electricity to get across the Atlantic? At the moment, that is completely hopeless. I see it in flying schools with electric aircraft that can do 25, 30-minute flights, or even perhaps up to an hour. But that's it. And then, of course, you have to sit and wait and recharge them or replace the entire battery. So there are so many downsides to this. And until the industry is forced, kicking and screaming, and you know, even with safety critical modifications, you often need to have the FAA putting out a demand that, you know, something is changed on an aircraft before an airline will actually fork out and make a change. They're so interested in keeping the shareholders, and the shareholders are equally interested in making money. And don't forget, some of those shareholders actually look after our pension pots. So, you know, we're as bad as anyone else for wanting them to be successful. I see nothing on the horizon. I'm very sorry to say. So how do I see the changing of civil aviation in the future? Well, probably there's someone being born now who might well see the end of civil aviation as we know it, because in 80 years' time, perhaps, fuel is going to start becoming very hard to find. The price of aviation fuel is going to start rising until it prices the average passenger out of the market. They won't be able to afford to fly anymore. They will return to the rich and famous, like it would have done in the early days of the 707, you know, in the 60s and 70s, until the 747 came along. It was only the rich and famous who got to fly across the world. It may return to that.
Yeah, I was going to say that. Your dad must have seen an awful lot of that kind of change, because it was a very much more elite sport, wasn't it, to go flying in airliners in the early days, and he would have seen a lot of that.
Yeah, my brother, this engineer I was staying, said he worked for the same company as the old man, and one of the most senior pilots used to drive up to the aircraft steps at Gatwick in his Bentley, and he would throw the keys to my brother, who was one of the Seaoff engineers, and say, my suitcase goes in the back and the Bentley goes in the car park. And then you walk up the steps and climb into his aircraft.
So you're saying that's not what you did at Virgin then?
Oh, if only. Yeah, I'm afraid not. We've gone down a bit since then, I'm afraid. No white gloves on the flight deck anymore.
All things change. My goodness.
Exactly.
Yeah, no, it is going to be interesting to see how it evolves. I mean, I guess the other perhaps slightly different perspective on it is we just don't know what we don't know yet in terms of how we're going to fix some of this. Obviously, this huge dynamic around environmental stuff at the minute that is driving a lot of behaviors in all sorts of different worlds and walks of life. But equally, when you look at where aviation has come from in a very limited time frame in terms of humanity, and how much that technology has evolved, and all technology has evolved. I think, someone being born now, 80 years time, who knows what the world's going to look like? So I don't know. I think we may well be doing it rather differently. And in fact, I'm fairly sure we will be doing it rather differently for all the reasons you mentioned, but I'm pretty sure we'll be matter transporting or something by then. Who knows what's going to be out there.
Well, I must admit, if you'd said to someone growing up 100 years ago, they would be saying now, where's the flying car? And the answer is, we don't really have the flying car yet, and we're not going to probably ever. So,
Yeah, but, at the same time, if you look at the internet and all those sorts of things, and you think, if someone you'd said to someone
even
50 years ago, yeah, absolutely, it would be extraordinary. Just a word on your APG podcast, because I can't have another podcaster on and not give you a chance to advertise here. What do you do on that? What's the kind of backstory and how's it work?
The podcast was started by Captain Jeff, who was a podcaster right at the dawn of podcasting, and he started a podcast called The Catholic Pilot. Which, when he realized that people who weren't religious might not want to listen to that, and it had no real religious basis at all, but Jeff is a devout Catholic, he decided to rename it. So he called it the Airline Pilot Guy Show, and then it took off. And he was on his own running it for many years, but slowly he built up a team of people who he got on with very well and had different aspects, different views of aviation. So he started off with Dr. Steph, who is a very competent and clever lady who is a back doctor and runs marathons and is a skydiver and did her commercial license for fun and spends her weekends throwing parachutists out of aircraft and also goes around the world running marathons and now ultra marathons or whatever those things are where you run bicycle and swim
even more miles in a day.
Exactly. She's just a lady who burns her candle at both ends and seems to get away with it. She's marvelous. So she joined and she's got a great perspective from where she sits. Rick was the next guy. He's a cargo pilot. So that's another area of aviation that's very interesting. And he was a captain. He flew the Dream Lifter, I think it's called, the big 7-4 that flew components around for Boeing, or perhaps still does. And he's 777 man, 747 man. So he's got the Boeing perspective. And he does an awful lot of flying. He works very hard. And I was lucky enough to be invited to join. And I bought a bit of a military perspective as well as Airbus. So we formed the basis of the team. The most recent guy to join us is another Nick, who I met when he bought with a team, he was just part of it, a C-47 to the UK, and took part in the, 75th anniversary of D-Day.
Parachute drops and things. Yep.
Yeah, they did all that kind of stuff. So the C-47 is Betty's biscuit bomber, and it's now back in the States, and they do that stuff there. But he's a licensed engineer and knows a lot about aviation, and also works for a military aviation manufacturer. So together we meet weekly and we talk about the latest week's news in aviation. People get interested in us as individuals, so we chat about that. I have produced well over 350 now segments about aviation history, generally speaking, or personal stories, a bit like your personal stories of your career. And they get fed in every now and again when we have time, and I've managed to make one. So that's called Plane Tales, and it actually features as its own podcast as well as being on the APG website. You can find it on any podcatcher. And if you like a little 20-minute story about an aspect of aviation, from airships and gliders through to Apollo 13 and, you know, the whole nine yards is in there. So that's been keeping me busy. But you can find our podcast. They've got a very good website called airlinepilotguy.com. They just have a search for that. On Facebook, we're just Airline Pilot Guy. On X, at APG Crew. And it's very similar on Instagram, APG Crew. And, of course, we put out as an audio-only podcast, but if you're interested, we video all the making of every podcast, which is obviously on YouTube. You can search for Airline Pilot Guy there, and you'll find a visual, and warts and all, I'm afraid.
Yeah, I've seen a couple of those, and I have to say it's a great show. The ones I've listened to, I think, are absolutely fascinating. If you have even a passing interest in aviation, it's really good. And I'll put those links in the sort of preamble for this as well.
Yeah, that's very kind of you, Bob. Thanks.
Not at all. Hey, Nick, you've been incredibly generous with your time. And I'm very grateful. And it's fabulous to catch up with you after a long time not doing that. So thank you ever so much for all your insights, and take care.
Oh, that's very kind of you, Bob. It's been an absolute pleasure. You look after yourself.
You too. Thanks, Nick.